Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
We're back. April 16th, 2022. It's a full moon. There's been some word going on about Dave Lynch's world, that there was possibly going to be a new movie released at the Cannes Film Festival. To our surprise, David Lynch was getting trolled, we found out. Dave Lynch had to release a statement on Thursday night saying, no, I am not releasing a film. So a lot of these fans that we saw getting behind David Lynch 6 months ago have turned on him. And so in defense of David Lynch, we're calling this podcast a War on Christmas special. And so I want to start out with about 3 minutes of David Lynch talking about dreams, an interpretation of dreams. And then our friends from Final Straw Radio have started a new podcast. And we're going to get an update on Eric King. And we need to do a whole show on Eric King because it's absolutely unbelievable, the gauntlet that man is going through. And so there's human rights violations there. The prison system is insane, and it has to be stopped. And of course we've been focusing on the Jackson County Jail and stopping that. So Eric King is going out to USP Lee, which is in the western part of Virginia, a remote area of Virginia. And so they build this, and they said, oh, this is a job creator. Well, we're not really seeing that many people, even in remote areas, wanting prison jobs. And to be honest, over-the-road trucking is much more appealing than being a prison guard. So they can't find enough sadists in the rural areas anymore, is what I'm getting at. But the other thing is they built this prison, and it stressed out the sewer system of the county. And this is exactly what I was saying about this Jackson County Jail when they left Platte County and hooked up to the Kansas City sewage system, which is like a $2.5 billion system that was just completed with the expectation of expanding it to $25 billion, where they have these centrifuges that'll take all the gold teeth and stuff I don't want to get into this too deep, but it's a centrifuge, and then they sell biosolids from the excrements. I don't know exactly. I'm not a horticulturist, but y'all get what I'm getting at. So they're getting all free infrastructure building this Jackson County jail. And of course, the owners run the Kansas City Chiefs. And this is the Hunt family of mass incarceration. And so these people that are not designing Jackson County Jail, they've designed the jails and prisons down in Alabama. Now, we had two more people die this week in Birmingham, Alabama. And it's been described as a fentanyl farm, the county jail. We're seeing two fentanyl overdoses in Missouri Department of Corrections every day. Okay, so there's serious issues going on. So the only thing I can do is call a war on Christmas. And so we're going to start out with 364. We're going to listen to Dave Lynch. We're going to listen to Final Straw do a very interesting podcast that they put together. And it's about the state of the social movement. There's been a paradigm shift. And this is the first broadcast that I've seen anybody mention this in detail. And so go ahead and hit that mic, 364.
What are your fears? Pretty much the regular, fears.
Do you dream?
I feel like if it's a psychiatrist.
No, well, that's good.
yeah, I dream, but I don't go by nighttime dreams. nighttime dreams are, they're sometimes some good ones, but it's daydreams that I love. And sinking down, sitting comfortably in a chair, where you might be controlling some of the thoughts and directing yourself here or there, but at a certain point, the dream takes over, and you enter in a place where things are unraveling before you without your intervention. And many things can present themselves that way, and sometimes ideas that you fall in love with.
You've been in therapy?
One time.
One time?
Yeah.
What happened? I mean, you just decided that...
I've told the story before.
Oh, I haven't heard it.
No, it's okay. Well, I went in, I had a reason, for going
sure.
in. And then I asked them straight out, right up front, could this process that we're going to go through affect creativity? And he said, David, I have to be honest with you, it could. And so then I had to shake his hand and
say goodbye. This is not for me.
Yeah, because it's a magical thing, and you don't want to know so much that would stop it from happening.
Do you understand creativity?
No, I understand the pleasure, joy of it, and I understand that. It's a beautiful process to go. Just like any invention or anything starts with an idea, and the idea then gets manifested in the material world. It's a beautiful process, and many internal rewards in the doing.
If David Lynch went back and looked at his own beginnings and wanting to be a painter and all that is part of your history, what would it tell us about David Lynch, the filmmaker?
If I want to go back?
If you went back and looked at your childhood and the shaping influences on you, would it be instructive about you and as a filmmaker?
I had a no. I think, it doesn't matter where you are growing up. It has something to do with just sensing your environment and... having the things triggered by the environment and your sensing, it could be anywhere because the same things happen everywhere. As long as there's human beings and houses and trees, it will happen.
This is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist, anti-authoritarian radio show broadcasting from occupied Chaligi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from people, projects, and struggles around the world engaging in the long project toward liberation. You can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net or at protonmail.com, and send us letters at P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina, 28816. This week we're pleased to present something a little bit new for TFS listeners. This is a kind of informal roundtable discussion that co-host Scott and I had alongside Vicki Osterweil, who has been on the show before to speak on her book In Defense of Looting, A Riotous History of Uncivil Action. We all sat down to talk about a short and thought-provoking article which was published in January of 2022 called The Interregnum, The George Floyd Uprising, The Coronavirus Pandemic, and The Emerging Social Revolution, which was published on The Haters Cafe, and we will link to it in the show notes for anyone interested in reading it. An interregnum is defined as being a period of discontinuity in a government, organization, or social order, and it typically points to points at which there isn't a clear monarch or reigning body in a given place. The article points to the many ways the George Floyd uprising, the COVID-19 pandemic, the rise of anti-work, and what the article calls the Great Refusal, which is a pivot from the Great Resignation nomenclature of some mass media, have all created the conditions for a possible broad-scale social revolution. Also, stay tuned to the end of the episode if you're hearing the podcast version where we chat briefly about what books we're reading right now. We hope you enjoy this chat. A note on the audio, I messed up recording on my side, which is my bad, but Scott saved the audio by doing their own backup recording. If you're listening to the radio broadcast and would like to hear the full conversation, head over to our blog at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org.
Stone Mountain was intended by, quote, lost cause, unquote, supporters as a Confederate Mount Rushmore, including a large bas relief carving, and was maybe the site of the second KKK, being born in 1915. More info can be found on the Twitter for Atlanta Justice Alliance, and some background on this case can be found in a prior Final Straw interview with Flower. Also, a call-in campaign continues until we hear otherwise for Eric King, anarchist prisoner who recently won a court case against jailers at the Federal Bureau of Prisons. After the case, they decided to transfer him to a higher security facility across the country. The BOP has a history of setting Eric up to get jumped by white supremacist prisoners at other facilities, and the worry is that not only is this move an obvious act of vengeance by the BOP, but that he'll be isolated and targeted at USP Lee or whatever facility that they stick him in. You can find notes about the call at supporterickking.org in our chat with Eric from April 3rd, 2022, or in the recent It's Going Down, This is America interview on the subject. Libre Flot, a French anarchist and former volunteer alongside the YPG in Rojava, has ended his hunger strike after a judge released him for medical reasons, but he'll be electronically monitored by the state pending a future court case, as reported by Abolition Media. Likely future updates and ways to support Libre Flot can be found at solidarity2december8.wordpress.com. Finally, Mountain Valley Pipeline resistor Max is facing a bunch of legal fees for locking down to block the delivery of pipeline to the MVP construction project, and is looking to get some support for covering the costs. More info on that can be found at tinyurl.com/madmaxfines.
Three of us are sitting down, me and Scott and Vicki Osterweil, who has been on the show before and has written a bunch of really amazing stuff in defense of looting primarily, or we had her on the show to talk about that book. And we are just all here to talk about this article on Haters Cafe, which is a blog run by primarily black and brown proletarian folks. And this article is called The Interregnum, The George Floyd Uprising, The Coronavirus Pandemic, and The Emerging Social Revolution. And we're just all here to talk about it a little bit. It's not an interview. It's sort of a departure from the, you know, format of The Final Straw has drawn in so far. And I'm excited to talk with y'all about this really thought-provoking piece.
Yeah, so I thought this is Scott, and I thought I'd start, just give a quick little, like, summary overview of the piece. The piece is written in points, but I'm going to just kind of bring them all together. I thought this piece was really helpful and interesting because it ties together a bunch of different important phenomena, especially, like, recent ones, not just the pandemic, the George Floyd uprisings, and the Great Resignation, which this piece says we should rename the Great Refusal, but also the longer arc of rebellion over the last 10 years. And basically, there's this claim in the piece that the insurrection that we saw from George Floyd uprisings has been translated into daily life. And so the struggle has left the realm of the political and now is possibly moving towards a social revolution. And I think that's good to kind of set us up for a conversation.
Yeah, totally. Like, first of all, thank you so much. It's so nice to be back here with y'all on one of my favorite shows. It's such a pleasure just to chat, especially under these circumstances. You know, when we scheduled this, things have changed globally. So it's exciting. It's exciting to sit and, like, think, reground ourselves and, like, you know, sort of thinking through our local context and what that looks like. It's just really valuable. So I appreciate you and I appreciate the audience too. I think when one of the things that sort of, you know, about this piece that I found, like, really sort of activating, I guess, like, is the way in which I think we have been, it talks about the Great Resignation, which has been this, like, wave of quitting, mass wave of quitting in jobs that has gone on now basically since the beginning of the pandemic, but, like, it accelerated really dramatically in 2021, and I haven't seen January numbers, but I know that even through December, it continued to accelerate. People are quitting their jobs more and more. Some of that is almost certainly due to, like, the pandemic and, like, the conditions of work that produces, and some people have, like, when I've talked to comrades about starting to see, you know, the general strike of the enslaved as a real thing, as a thing that happened, as he describes it. But, you know, every year, even before the Civil War, 50,000 enslaved people, obviously most of them illiterate, in many ways facing incredibly difficult modes of communication between separate plantations, even within plantations, although as more and more scholars are demonstrating, they were very, very good at communicating, and there was a very, very dense communication network that famously Harriet Tubman used to spy on Confederate soldiers. So anyway, in any case, like, there is also, in response to Jim Crow and the sort of fascist regime in the South, the post-slavery fascist regime in the South, or post-Reconstruction, you have the Great Migrations, which I think don't get talked about as labor action, right, in the same way. Even though, like, people like Ida B. Wells at the time understood them as such, right? The nostalgia for the classical workers' movement isn't just a kind of Marxist, although it is often, like, sort of worshipping of a particular industrial proletariat, which, again, like, lots of Marxists don't do, but a lot of them do as well. It's not just that. It's also, like, a refusal to recognize Black and Indigenous forms of resistance historically in the country. And so I think it's not surprising that in the wake of a, you know, Black uprising that, you know, spread so widely to all of society, that then we would be seeing these tactics that have a more historical echo with practices of marinage, migration, mass sort of networked action that aren't necessarily organized into the sort of solidarity fist of the union in exactly the same way. And, you know, I don't want to get all, like, you know, start talking about Deleuze or whatever the hell, but, like, I think there's a real opportunity here, I think, and the reason that I wanted to have this conversation, I think we all did, is because we are actually in a moment when, like, things really feel like they're at stake, and, like, obviously, like, the war and the murder, all the events of the last few weeks have increased that feeling that, like, there's high stakes. But I also think, like, what the piece says is that, like, and I agree with, is that, like, the proletariat, like, the class is on the attack, it's on the offensive right now. And, like, I hate we have to formulation. I really don't like them. But, like, it is a valuable opportunity to, like, rethink how we think about struggle, because I think it was so vital over the last 10 years that we have all of these political struggles. And it was so important. And the piece sort of argues that, you know, that without those struggles, there was no way that the George Floyd Rebellion could have emerged. But now there's this temptation to see things in patterns or as repetitions, to fail to recognize when things have changed, especially under the conditions that we understand them of what politics looks like, which is like unions, demands, parties, or even anarchists, but even like, you know, uprisings, insurrections. Like, I think we really need to like move past that as well. We, those of us who think of ourselves as, you know, insurrectionary types or whatever. And I think that all of these questions are like really up in the air right now. And if they were to merge with a kind of street movement, like, would provide a really serious opportunity for like total significant transformation. And I think that's the first time in my life I feel really comfortable like saying that on the radio and like feeling like that's real. You know what I mean? I'm starting to see, you know, the general strike of the enslaved as a real thing, as a thing that happened, as he describes it. But, you know, every year, even before the Civil War, 50,000 enslaved people, obviously most of them illiterate, in many ways facing incredibly difficult modes of communication between separate plantations, even within plantations, although as more and more scholars are demonstrating, they were very, very good at communicating, and there was a very, very dense communication network that famously Harriet Tubman used to spy on Confederate soldiers. So anyway, in any case, like, there is also, in response to Jim Crow and the sort of fascist regime in the South, the post-slavery fascist regime in the South, or post-Reconstruction, you have the Great Migrations, which I think don't get talked about as labor action, right, in the same way. Even though like people like Ida B. Wells at the time understood them as such, right? The nostalgia for the classical workers' movement isn't just a kind of Marxist, although it is often like sort of worshipping of a particular industrial proletariat, which again, like lots of Marxists don't do, but a lot of them do as well. It's not just that, it's also like a refusal to recognize Black and Indigenous forms of resistance historically in the country. And so I think it's not surprising that in the wake of a, you know, Black uprising that, you know, spread so widely to all of society, that then we would be seeing these tactics that have a more historical echo with practices of marinage, migration, mass sort of network action that aren't necessarily organized into the sort of solidarity fist of the union in exactly the same way. And, you know, I don't want to get all like, you know, start talking about Deleuze or whatever the hell, but like, I think there's a real opportunity here, I think, and the reason that I wanted to have this conversation, I think we all did, is because we are actually in a moment when, like, things really feel like they're at stake, and, like, obviously, like, the war and the murder, all the events of the last few weeks have increased that feeling that, like, there's high stakes, but I also think, like, what the piece says is that, like, and I agree with, is that, like, the proletariat, like, the class is on the attack, it's on the offensive right now. And, like, I hate we have to formulations. I really don't like them. But, like, it is a valuable opportunity to, like, rethink how we think about struggle, because I think it was so vital over the last 10 years that we have all of these political struggles. And it was so important. And the piece sort of argues that, you know, that without those struggles, there was no way that the George Floyd Rebellion could have emerged. But now there's this temptation to see things in patterns or as repetitions. To fail to recognize when things have changed, especially under the conditions that we understand them of what politics looks like, which is like unions, demands, parties, or even anarchists, like even like, you know, uprisings, insurrections. Like, I think we really need to like move past that as well. We, those of us who think of ourselves as, you know, insurrectionary types or whatever. And I think that all of these questions are like really up in the air right now. And if they were to merge with a kind of street movement, like, would provide a really serious opportunity for like total significant transformation. And I think that's the first time in my life I feel really comfortable like saying that on the radio and like feeling like that's real. You know what I mean?
We're back. It's the Abolitionist Hour. Thanks to our friends at Final Straw Radio, Asheville, North Carolina, Occupied Chalakwa Territory. And you can find them online and check out Final Straw interviews and past interviews and all that stuff. Now, as I promised on this war on Christmas, who was the Grinch? These keep in mind, these are terrible people. This is a content warning. We're going into dark territory here. This is a tragic tale, and there's hardly any good people that we're going to mention, but the ones there are a few, and I think that's where we are. That's where we are with the state of our civilization is who is it that chooses not to human traffic? You know, it doesn't matter if you've killed before. It's the people that made the decision, I'm not going along with this capitalist scheme any longer. And we have to support our political prisoners for their commitment, because we understand they can't live in this world of trees being clear-cut, pipelines being run. Marius Mason, Eric King, just to mention a few. But we're going to start out, how did the prison system get funded? And so we've got to talk about the savings and loan crisis that began in the mid-70s. And so we're going to talk about the key players and how the mafia got intertwined, and then we see how the mafia got intertwined, the war on drugs. And so the next part, we're going to start talking about the SNL crisis, and this is going to be clip 365, Mike. And if you would, go ahead and hit it.
First of all, as vice president during the Reagan-Bush years, he was the head of the Reagan-Bush deregulation efforts across the board, and that included savings and loans. And the deregulation of savings and loans that occurred primarily in 1982 with the St. Germain-Garn bill basically opened up savings and loans to the crooks. SNLs had traditionally just done home mortgage lending to middle-class Americans, and they succeeded very well for 50 years. They had some problems then in the late 70s and early 80s with the inflation, so the Reagan-Bush administration and Congress decided that they were going to deregulate, quote-unquote, savings and loans. And this allowed SNLs to basically invest their money and lend their money on anything they wanted to, and was an open invitation to the criminal element. And sure enough, the mafia was one of the first people, groups involved in looting SNLs in the early 80s. And the deregulation that Bush was in charge of did that. Bush also, as vice president, either he or his top aides intervened in the federal regulation of the biggest failed savings loan in the country at that time, Sunrise Savings in Boynton Beach, Florida. The CEO of Sunrise went up to Bush's office when he was vice president, and the story varies. He tells one story one time and one story another. He either met with Bush, with Bush's top aides, including C. Boyden Gray, who is the current White House counsel. And he asked them to get the federal regulators off his back. They were trying to stop Sunrise from basically throwing their assets away. And 1 week after he met with these people, the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, that regulates savings and loans, withdrew a very stringent cease and desist order against Sunrise and replaced it with a weak supervisory agreement. And a congressional study found that this move cost taxpayers possibly $100 million or more in keeping Sunrise open. Sunrise was then closed down a year and a half later, at a cost to the federal taxpayers of $700 million. And there was no Federal Home Loan Bank Board investigation. It was just shut down. And we find if you look at the major borrowers at Sunrise, you find mafia people, you find CIA people, and you find a Houston businessman named John Riddle, who ties into the circle of Houston businessmen that George Bush comes from. And Riddle, at this time, was involved in the transshipment of arms to the Middle East. Now, the top number two official at the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, Ann Fairbanks, was in this meeting with the Sunrise CEO when he was asking them to get the feds off his back. Her husband, Richard Fairbanks, was in charge at that time of the State Department's efforts to keep arms from Iran, called Operation Staunch. He quit a year later and became the Washington lawyer and lobbyist for Iraq and worked with Iraq until Iraq invaded Kuwait. Now, it's interesting also to note that the largest failed SNL in the country that did not have a Federal Home Loan Bank Board investigation, Sunrise was number two largest. The largest was Hill Financial in Red Hill, Pennsylvania, that plays a big part in my book. And the number two borrower at Hill Financial was John Riddle's buddy, a Houston builder named Mike Atkinson, who at that time was transshipping arms to the Middle East. So you find a connecting thread here of arms to the Middle East and savings and loans. And Bush's office was directly involved in keeping this Sunrise Savings open and was lending money to John Riddle. I think the mafia just found it as another, you know, trough they could feed at. And I think they were in on it at the beginning when they saw, they knew what deregulation was going to do. And the fact that they figured out a scheme, and the head of this scheme was a New York mobster named Mario Renda, who went to jail for like less than 3 years. He was convicted in New York, Florida, and Kansas City. Renda would collect money from various institutions like pension funds and credit unions, bundle it up into $100,000 bundles so it was covered by federal deposit insurance, and then place it in savings and loans all across the country, billions of dollars. And once he got the money, the deposits into an SNL, he could basically control them. He had a hammer over their head. If they didn't do with this money what he wanted to, he'd just pull it out. And this was called linked financing. He would place the deposits and then tell the SNLs to loan the money, to lend the money to his buddies. They would then just take it and rip it off. Now, in Texas, we found a Louisiana mobster named Herman K. Beebe, who was controlling SNLs in a different way than Renda. And we found Beebe and Renda together in many, many different places across the country, many connections between the two. But Beebe would actually finance the purchase of savings and loans by his associates like Don Dixon at Vernon, Carol Kelly at Continental, Jarrett Woods at Western, Roy Daly at First Savings of East Texas. And then he would have a hammer over their head where he was holding the note on their stock to the SNL so they would do what he wanted to. Correct. In fact, we had a sort of dry run on the SNL scandal in the mid-70s in Texas with the so-called Texas Rent-A-Bank scandal, where we have the same people that showed up in the SNL crisis ripping off small Texas banks and doing the same thing, trading bad loans between each other, trading capital stock loans between each other. And Herman K. Beebe was in the middle of that. Ben Barnes, his business partner, was in the middle of it. And then later, Ben Barnes and John Conley show up as big, big borrowers at many of the dirtiest SNLs in the country. George Albin, another guy that was involved in savings and loans, was in the Texas Rent-A-Bank scandal. So, and the federal government knew about the Rent-A-Bank scandal. They came in and did an investigation. There was a savings and loan in Texas, in Houston, called Surety, that a woman named Rosemary Stewart was in charge of the federal regulation of in Washington. And she saw Herman K.B., she saw Walter Mischer, she saw Mischer's son-in-law, Robert Corson. And when these people all got back in the SNLs 5 and 10 years later, she did nothing. And she was then in charge of the Office of Enforcement of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. Yeah, Walter Mischer was at the very center of the Houston business connection. You take all these SNLs and you start tracking back where the money goes, and you find Mischer and his friends. Mischer was what we call a hyphenated Texan, banker, hyphenated developer. And there's probably a few other hyphens in there, too. Political power broker. He controlled politicians on all levels. Mischer basically told the Houston developers who they were going to donate political campaign money to. Mischer had the third largest bank in Houston, Allied Bank, and he used Allied Bank to finance many different things, including some of the dirtiest savings and loans in Houston, like Continental Savings, Mainland Savings, and some others. And in fact, Mischer knew that the SNLs were going down the tubes in the early 80s because he sold a savings and loan he had, Ben Franklin Savings, that at one time had belonged to Lloyd Benson's company. He also ordered all the SNL K capital stock loans out of Allied in 82, 83, so that when these SNLs failed, he wouldn't be caught holding the bag. And in turn, he had many savings and loans helping he and his bank out indirectly. And one time, Mainland Savings in Houston bought a $20 million loan that Allied held on an oil company. It was in bankruptcy. And a later investigation showed that Mainland lost at least $14 million on this. There was no hope of repaying, and Mainland just did it as a favor to Allied. The CEO of Mainland had had his Mainland stock financed at Allied Bank and was a good friend of Walter Mischer. Well, Mischer goes back to the old 8F days, the Lamar Hotel in Houston, where the Brown brothers, Jesse Jones, Gus Wortham, these people were wheeling and dealing, controlling Houston, and politicians like Lyndon Johnson. It goes back that far. And then you bring Mischer was very close to John Conley, Ben Barnes, Lloyd Benson, and George Bush. And most of the Houston mayors and Harris County judges, almost all of the Texas governors, except for Ann Richards, I'm not sure about her, but we know Dolph Briscoe and even Republicans like Bill Clements, Mischer was very close to and supported. Mischer's political donations and influence went to both parties. It was not just Democrats. I mean, he supported Democrats, of course, back in the 50s and 60s when Democrats controlled the state, but he also, you know, controlled and helped a lot of Republicans like John Tower and George Bush and Bill Clinton.
So he was a well-connected fellow.
Very well connected, and not just, of course, the politicians. He was connected to the mafia,
well, that's
which was a big shock. I mean, when I was reporting the Houston Post, and people started telling me about his connections to the mafia, and we did a big interview with him, and it was on the cover of the Houston Post Sunday magazine, and I asked him, what about all the rumors about your connections to Carlos Marcello, the New Orleans mafia boss? And he admitted that he had sat down to do business with Marcello. And one time, Marcello had come in and wanted to buy a couple of his hotels, including the Carousel Hotel on the South Loop. And he said he did not sell them to him because he did not want to get, quote, run out of town. Well, it turns out when you investigate who he really sold it to, it turns out to be a Marcello frontman and associate. So he really did, and Mischer and his partners kept the deed, the title, to this hotel, while Marcello's frontman was showing the X-rated movies and running prostitutes in this hotel.
And what about H.K. Beebe, his connections with Walter Mischer and the mob?
Yeah, well Beebe, the Louisiana Mafia associate from Shreveport, had turned up first in the Texas Rent-A-Bank scandal, where he was connected to Ben Barnes, who, of course, was in Walter Mischer's hip pocket. Beebe then was borrowing money from Mischer's Allied Bank. Mischer was supporting him, making him operating loans, giving him insurance business. And in one case, the stock of Continental Savings in Houston was financed at Mischer's Allied Bank with a guarantee from Herman K. Beebe. So they were very close in doing business not only in the Houston area, but in Louisiana. We find associates of Mischer, very close associates, including the former controller of the currency, Robert Clark, going in and buying a bank with Herman K. Beebe in Louisiana, along with the two top executives at Mischer's bank.
Now, was Beebe under Marcello?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And this had been determined actually by the Texas Attorney General's Organized Crime Strike Force in the mid-70s. John Hill has actually had an organized crime investigative unit headed by, I believe, Tim James, and they found the connections between Herman K. Beebe and Carlos Marcello. Beebe was also tied to Marcello by the New Orleans Metropolitan Crime Commission. This is back in the mid-70s. Then you find all of the connections then later with the SNL scandal.
Move on.
Well, they would, in Beebe's case, he would actually finance the controlling stock of an SNL, and then the loans would be made to either Beebe or his associates, and then they would take the money and walk the loans. and leaving the SNL with property that wasn't worth anywhere near what they'd lent on it. And that's the way they basically fail.
How did the CIA get involved then with these people?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think we know the final answer yet. There are some people that believe that William Casey had been in on the beginning of the deregulation and knew that it was susceptible. You know, Casey was an old Wall Street lawyer and head of the SEC at one time, and knew that the SNLs were very vulnerable to being looted and the money taken out and never found. But on the other hand, we have people like Walter Mischer, who are connected to the CIA, can probably see that if they keep the CIA happy, you know, diverting some of the money to CIA operations, then, you know, they will get what the FBI calls the CIA's get-out-of-jail-free card. In other words, if they're working, doing, helping the CIA and they get caught, then the CIA can come in and say, don't prosecute this person, he's working with us. And that happened on a number of occasions in the SNL crisis.
Hey, we're back. We're talking about the SNL crisis. We just started with 1970. Lyndon Johnson lived across the street from the head of the DOJ at the time, from 1950 until he became vice president. So you had the DOJ looking the other way. You had the CIA blocking extraditions. You had the mafia coming in and cleaning out the mom and pop savings and loans. And so people are beginning to ask, well, what's this got to do with Kansas City? Well, clip 366, Mike, hit it, and we're going to bring it home.
Don't prosecute this person, he's working with us. And that happened on a number of occasions in the SNL crisis, where we would have a savings and loan looter or a bank looter getting caught by the FBI and the Justice Department, the CIA, trying to get them off the hook because they work with them.
Now, we've had on Alternative Views, those of you who've been watching Alternative Views regularly know that about the drug scams which were going on, where illegal arms would be shipped down to the Contras particularly, and the C-130s would be filled up with cocaine and all and brought back in the United States and offloaded, sometimes at U.S. Air Force bases, sometimes at more covert landing strips.
Well, it's not like the CIA would you'd get a loan from an SNL and down the bottom line, you know, for guns to the Contras.
Signed by the CIA.
Right. That's not the way they operate. I mean, they use cutouts and front people so that to maintain their plausible deniability, so they can come in and deny that it wasn't them.
And what's a cutout then?
A cutout is a front man, a middle person who may not even know he's working for the CIA. I think there could be four or five levels of cutouts in front men, the layers that the CIA would, the money would flow through so that it couldn't be tracked back to the CIA. One of the best examples we have in the SNLs was when Mainland Savings, this is the SNL that Walter Mischer was financing the stock of. This is the SNL whose chairman of the board, Raymond Hill, was a close and longtime friend of James A. Baker III. White House Chief of Staff, former Treasury Secretary, former Secretary of State, George Bush's best friend. When Mainland failed, James Baker's old law firm, Andrews & Kurt, in Houston, was brought in by the feds to investigate the failure and file a lawsuit against the officers and directors to try to recover the lost money. Andrews & Kurt investigated, actually drew up a lawsuit, a petition, but it was never filed. It was stopped at the top layers of Andrews & Kurt and the federal government. And as a result, no lawsuit was ever filed against Raymond Hill, the Mainland CEO, and no money was ever recovered. No indictments have ever been filed against anybody in the failure of Mainland Savings. Okay, so here we have this SNL. It's wired in to Walter Mischer and James Baker. In the summer of 1985, James Baker went before a Senate Finance Committee as Treasury Secretary and told them that there was nothing to worry about in the SNL. Everything was wonderful and fine, and nothing bad was going to happen. At the very same time, Mainland Savings was entering into a $68 million land deal with Adnan Khashoggi, a Saudi Arabian middleman and arms dealer. And it was a very complicated deal. The result of it was that Khashoggi walked away with about $16 million in cash profit, pure profit from this land deal. The taxpayers later got stuck with about a $50 million loss on this deal. This was closed. This deal was closed, and the money transferred on August the 1st, 1985. 6 days later, Adnan Khashoggi begins the transfer of $5 million to Ghabanifar, the Iranian middleman, to start the first publicized arms for hostages deal. It's interesting that he transferred $5 million to Ghabanifar because at the same time, Mainland was basically giving him $16 million. They also gave him a $5 million letter of credit that was very strange because it could only be drawn on in the first week in November of 85. And it had all the earmarks of a guarantee. And in fact, later when Khashoggi's people were trying to cover this up from the FBI, who caught on to this pretty soon, they said it was to guarantee some stock that Khashoggi had bought from Mainland. But the money to buy that stock had come from Mainland in this deal. In other words, Mainland gave Khashoggi $10 million. He gives it back to them in exchange for $10 million in stock. And they said, oh, by the way, here's a letter of credit for $5 million to guarantee this stock. It didn't make any sense at all because it came from Mainland. The money came from Mainland, but the $5 million matches exactly the $5 million that Khashoggi paid Ghabanifar.
So, Pete, this is, in a sense, the beginning of Iran-Contra that's funded with SNL money. So one of the reasons why Baker and Bush and the U.S. government was not regulating the SNLs, was not doing something about this crisis that was emerging, is because they were using the SNLs to finance some of their off-the-book activities they didn't want Congress or the public to look into. Is that a correct?
I think that's ultimately what happened. Now, whether we can prove that they, quote, used them, you know, we'll probably never know, but that is the ultimate upshot of what happened. And the money, of course, from Mainland ultimately came from the American taxpayers. So we, in a sense, were financing these covert illegal operations. And it's the way that, of course, Oliver North and William Casey, it's the way, George Bush, the way they like to do things. I mean, North testified before Congress that what William Casey was looking for and trying to set up was a self-sustaining, off-the-shelf, self-financing, covert operation. And here we had it. We see it in operation with the savings and loan money that ultimately came from the American taxpayer. So, you know, Khashoggi wasn't out any money. The Iranians and Israelis really weren't out anymore. It came from the American taxpayers. I think Dixon and Keating and all the others, Ed McBurney, Jarrett Woods, Tyrell Barker, were just front men. I mean, they were cutouts, basically. And if you look at how much money they got, I call them one or two percenters. Dixon got maybe, what, $20 million out of Vernon? I mean, he himself. And Vernon is costing taxpayers over $1 billion. Keating got about $40 million. And Lincoln Savings is costing taxpayers $2 billion. So you can see you're getting 1% or 2%. And it's a classic front man setup. And the people that you have to, who's really getting this money, and you start scratching and digging, you find that you're in another stratum, as you say, of businessmen who are connected to the politicians very strongly. Of course, Keating had strong connections too, but if you look at who got the money out of Lincoln, you find John Connally and Ben Barnes getting close to $100 million. You find a little bank in Paris called Saudi European.
Paris, Texas.
Paris, France.
Paris, France.
Yeah. Oh. It connects into the BCCI.
Oh, I see.
And Keating was investing money in that. And you start scratching and digging, you find even bigger players than Keating behind this. Well, the banks and insurance companies, believe it or not, were some of the big institutions that got bailed out by the SNLs. If you had a piece of property or an office building, the first mortgage or the first lien on it might be held by a big bank or a big insurance company. And when the savings and loan would come in and take out everything and refinance the whole deal, the banks and SNLs would get paid off by the savings and loan. In fact, that happened in the Khashoggi deal. Texas Commerce Bank had a $15 million mortgage against Khashoggi's property. And the money to pay off that mortgage came from Mainland Savings and also Lamar Savings in Austin joined in that. So Texas Commerce Bank got all their money back from the savings and loans. You find it happen time and time again. A piece of property will have a first mortgage by a bank or insurance company that will get paid off by the SNL when they take the whole deal out.
Well, as I understand, the big banks, I mean the Wall Street banks and all.
Well, sure. I mean, if they're holding the first mortgage, they're going to get the money first before anybody. And a savings loan might be holding a third or fourth mortgage. I mean, they would wrap these things and flip these things so that the SNL might be third or fourth in line and would never get, once the property sold and the first mortgagee is paid off, the SNL is left with nothing.
Pete, there's a chapter of your book called The Mobsters, Spooks, and George Bush, The Palmer National Bank Story, that ties all these things that we're talking about together. In other words, the way that high-level officials with connections to the government, corporate, and political officials formed a bank, the Palmer National Bank, and how it became connected with all these unsavory operations. Do you want to give us some detail on this to sort of concretely illustrate this analysis?
The Palmer National Bank had just about everybody in it. It was a small bank, still exists in Washington, D.C., about two blocks north of the White House. It was started by a Louisiana businessman named Harvey McLean and a political operative in Washington, D.C. called Stephen Halper. And McLean and Halper met in 1980 when they were both working on George Bush's presidential campaign. And Halper later was head of the policy group for Bush. And then when Reagan became the nominee and Bush was named vice presidential candidate, Halper went to work for their campaign as part of the policy group and was actually a high-level official in what they call the October Surprise Group, a group that was trying to determine whether or not Carter was going to pull off an October surprise and get the Iranian hostages home or whatever. And Halper was in charge of this group. His father-in-law was Ray Klein, who was the former deputy director of intelligence of the CIA. Klein was working with them, with Bush. And then when Reagan and Bush won, Halper went to work for the State Department. They created a position for him. And James Baker, by the way, was the one that brought Halper over to the Reagan-Bush team after Reagan became the nominee from the Bush team. And Harvey McLean was a businessman from Shreveport, Louisiana, and he was being financed by none other than Herman K. Beebe, the mafia associate. McLean moves to Dallas and buys Paris Savings and Loan in Paris, Texas, and is borrowing money from Vernon Savings, from Continental Savings in Houston, and later, of course, all these loans go bad and Paris goes bust, and McLean's business deals cost taxpayers probably over $100 million. That's kind of getting ahead of the story. Back in 83, McLean and Halper are taking a trip to China, and they start talking about, let's get a bank in Washington, D.C. So they start Palmer National Bank. Palmer was named after McLean's grandmother and daughter. And the capital, the $3 million capital to start the bank, came. That you find the same people and the same threads running through these operations, and the money, you know, from SNLs going into these operations. Wow.
Can you tell us another story about a landing strip in Lajitas, Texas?
Yes. I first found out about the possible connections to the savings and loans and the CIA in, I guess, the fall of 1988 when a woman in Houston called up my associate at the Houston Post, Greg C., and told him, berated him about some of our coverage of SNLs that weren't getting the whole story. So we went to see her. Her name was Rebecca Sims. She had been Robert Corson, Mishra's former son-in-law, his accountant. And she had quit because she'd been asked to commit bankruptcy and tax fraud. And so she started investigating Corson. And she found out that Corson had been an asset of the CIA. And when she first told me that, I really wasn't interested in it at all. I had no interest in it. I wasn't looking for the CIA. I was looking for the mafia. And I guess I was even a little disappointed. But when I went back to my office, I remembered several things. One, when we had done the story on Walter Mischler and had been calling everybody, all his people he knew, and just get background information on him, one of his close associates told me about the 700,000 acres in Belize in Central America that he had bought into, and that his associate thought that this was a CIA operation. And this was someone who's very close to Mischler and would not say something like that unless he knew it had something to. And I sort of filed that, you know, away in my mind. I remembered that came up, and then I remember there was a organized crime strike force prosecutor in Kansas City that was chasing Mario Renda, the New York mob money broker. And I was chasing Renda too, so we had a lot of contact. I'd been sending him our stories we'd been writing in the Houston Post, and he said almost the same thing Rebecca Sims had said: you're missing something big here, there's something you're not getting. And so I wondered if he was talking about the CIA. So I flew out to Kansas City and met with him, and sure enough, that was it. He was talking about the CIA. So that's how the CIA connection arose. And Rebecca Sims had been told about the CIA connection from a man named Richard Brennecke.
All right, we're back. It's 7:56 p.m. in the Midwest. Yeah, so now we're seeing we're seeing investigators in Kansas City on the SNL situation, organized crime, CIA, DOJ looking the other way, and so the plot is thickening. So this is the guns are already starting to run into South America. And a little bit later we'll talk about how the arms trade is involved in this when we get to John Stockwell. But we're going to go ahead and do one more. We're a little bit behind because I ran a longer program or added one, but I think we can get through the majority of this. And 368. If you could, Mike, go ahead and hit that one.
That I knew how. And if so, you told somebody in, say, May of this year that you could get a book published in 5 months, they would have laughed at you. So it was not possible. Well, we did it, but just barely.
Pete, let's talk a little bit about the sort of final response of your work by the establishment, by journalists, Congress, and then possibly the public, and how you reacted to the sort of non-response of the sort of journalist establishment and then the Congress. You yourself were a reporter for the Houston Post. You published these articles about the CIA and the SNL, so were explosive, investigative reporting, and they just weren't picked up by the national media. What did this lead you to conclude towards the press in the United States?
Well,
did this change your attitude anyway?
Well, number one, they never did what they should have done, which was track any of the money. They relied on the CIA for all their information, and even the CIA admitted that of the 20 institutions we named, that they had dealt with four of them, and that they had dealt with five of the individuals we had named, but they had done nothing wrong. And the thing is that the staff director of the House Intelligence Committee, who was overseeing the investigation, a guy named Dan Childs, had come from the CIA. He was the chief financial officer of the CIA and had been brought over to the intelligence subcommittee right before my stories came out. And the CIA, of course, was aware. I mean, I had been talking to them for months, so they knew that my stories were going to break soon. Dan Childs also had been brought in 10 years earlier in the Senate Intelligence Committee that had been doing the church investigation, was exposing all the illegal domestic activities of the CIA. Childs had been brought in for damage control. It certainly looked like he was being brought in for damage control. And in fact, after they released their report saying there was nothing to this, Childs went back to see, now he's the executive assistant to the CIA director.
This is shameless. It's like this guy Polgar, who was put in charge of investigating Iran-Contra, who is another lifetime CIA operative, station chief of about six different places, as you point out in your book. So basically, Congress didn't do anything.
No.
They covered it up. The press really didn't do anything. And now the Clinton administration faces as much as a $500 billion price tag for the CIA scandal. So what can the government finally do about this?
Congress and the Justice Department can track the money. That's all they have to do. And if there was fraud involved, they can get it back. And they haven't done this. I mean, everybody's acting like it's a foregone conclusion that we've lost $500 billion. You know, okay, taxpayers, take the hit and go on. It's not true. The Justice Department is very capable of tracking this money. They can track drug money that starts out as cash in the United States, goes offshore and comes back. Surely they can track S&L money that's always a paper or wire transfer. It's easy to track if you got subpoena power. Congress could do it, but they're not doing it. And I don't know whether Clinton is going to make the Justice Department do this or not. You know, where it's going to be interesting to see who the new Attorney General is going to be and whether they're going to go out. I mean, I don't see any indication on Clinton's part that he has any interest in kicking this sleeping dog. I think he just wants to let it lie and not mess with it, because his party is just as involved as the Republicans. And so I don't see, there's going to have to take just be mass revolt by the American people, and the American people don't have the information.
You're watching Alternative Views. We turn now to some news stories from the Alternative Press. World Press Review has some stories, some opinions of various newspapers are around the world. Most of the quotes are, not all that significant, but there are a couple of them that I thought you might be interested in. One from Munich Independent newspaper says it's difficult to discern a program or policy in the new president's persona. He succeeded in pleasing everyone and antagonizing no one. The conclusion was that Clinton was not elected. Bush was summarily fired. And in Tehran, they said that our experience with the USA during the past half century has left us with no illusions about either Republicans or Democrats. A desire for hegemony is so deep-rooted in the psyche of the American political establishment that the new president, even though he's a Democrat, has no choice but to tread the path of norm in traditional USA foreign policy.
One of Bill Clinton's chief campaign pledges was to limit the influence of lobbyists in Washington, D.C. Well, the New York Times News Service reports that his transition team has extensive industry and ties to foreign countries. For instance, Vernon Jordan, the transition chairman, earns at least $442,000 a year in fees from sitting on the boards of 11 corporate giants, including Union Carbide, American Express, Xerox, and the debt-laden RJR Nabisco. Jordan also holds almost $1 million worth of stock in these companies. And his law firm, Aiken Gump Hauer and Feld, represents at least seven of these corporations as well, and as a senior partner, he shares in the law firm's profits. The transition director, working right under Jordan, Warren Christopher, is the senior partner in one of the nation's largest law firms, O'Melveny & Myers, whose clients include Mitsui, Sumitomo Trust and Banking, Japan Airlines, and Hyundai. And during the campaign, Clinton made a point of criticizing lobbyists who work for foreign interests, but the Japanese interests, at least, are well represented in his transition team. As well, Christopher earned at least $73,000 last year from sitting on the boards of Lockheed Corporation and Southern California Edison, and his firm also represents both corporations. So you can imagine what sort of feelings this person is going to have about regulating utilities and also military cutbacks. Also, Mickey Cantor, another board member on the transition team, is a member of Manet Phelps, Phillips and Cantor, which has done work for the government, done work for the governments of Cyprus and Jamaica, and for a wide array of for-profit healthcare corporations, real estate, and transportation firms. He also does lobbying for Japan's NEC Corporation, the cable television industry, and a number of big oil companies. He also, on the side, conducted a policy briefing for a number of his clients and potential clients, including General Electric. Samuel Berger, another member, the transition team's foreign policy director, also has for years presided over an international trade firm, the international trade practice at Hogan and Hartson, a law firm whose clients have included Poland, Czechoslovakia, the Bahamas, Ontario, Japan again, and the trading arm of China, as well as the Toshiba Corporation of Japan. And when Toshiba got in trouble with the U.S. government for exporting sensitive technology to the Soviet the former Soviet Union, Berger was there in Washington helping to defend Toshiba's interests. As Ralph Nader put it, Cesar Chavez isn't getting any calls, and there have been widespread complaints from the coalition that elected Clinton, which includes many civil rights leaders, people working for migrant farmers, people working for other minority rights, that people from these institutions just haven't been called upon. Clinton's gone for the traditional lobbyists and lawyers who have always been sitting inside the Beltway dictating what's done to the congressmen.
See, they're not going to point out other connections and interconnections with Clinton and the staff that he's putting together. For instance, I look at the sociology of leadership. What organizations do these people come from? And who are the other people that they associate with? Well, Bill Clinton was a member of the Bilderberger, that secret organization, as well as the Council on Foreign Relations. Vernon Jordan is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission. Warren Christopher is a member of all three of those elite organizations. Henry Cisneros is a member of the CFR. And, of course, Lloyd Benson, they say you're going to be our new Secretary of Treasury. He has attended Bilderberg meetings recently as well. So the people that Clinton has in his transition team are people from this very small group of elite organizations. And very few people are members of these organizations. Council on Foreign Relations only has about 1,500 to 1,700. But the number of people in government from these organizations is huge compared to their size. So we're seeing the same type of thing that we did before in the in the Bush and Reagan years. They came from these organizations.
Well, the Carter people too.
And the Carter. So it's just basically Carter. Carter revisited, except Clinton is more conservative than Carter, and Clinton came from the. Democratic Leadership Council, which was a rebellion against the liberal hegemony of the Democrats, and I saw a statistic where it said that the Congress people, who also support the Democratic Leadership Council, they voted with the Reagan-Bush years. They voted for Reagan and Bush 80% to 90% of the time. World Press Review has a couple of articles about the Mafia, which are really quite disturbing. It says that the Mafia, like the rest of the economy in the 80s, has gone global and has forged alliances wherever it's needed to, killed wherever it's needed to, and is sponsoring indigenous crime syndicates under its control in a lot of countries where they weren't operating before, particularly, say, in Eastern Europe. It has managed to come to grips and work out relationships with the Turkish heroin bosses, the Colombia drug cartels. So internationally, it's stronger than it ever has been. And even, you know, you hear references here and there to the Russian mafia taking over so much of what is happening in the chaos in Russia right now. Well, that mafia is actually connected with the Italian-Sicilian mafia. Things have changed a bit, though, in that the mafia still kills in Italy. They've seen that. However, they've kind of gone along with the Colombian style of killing now. They use, instead of just very clean assassinations with their rifles or so, there that were submachine guns. They're doing it now with car bombs, which actually kills some a lot of civilians as well. As an indication of the strength and internationalization of the mafia, on St. Valentine's Day, appropriately enough, in 1989, there was a meeting in Nice of members of the international consortium of illegals. The Sicilian Mafia, which is the octopus, the giant mafia, they also, with representatives of the Colombian and Venezuelan cartels, well, they all got together so that they could divide up the world's spoils, so that they wouldn't have competition with each other, they wouldn't be trampling on each other, or they wouldn't have to be killing each other. Cartelization of crime around the world. And what's happening in Italy? There have been some well-publicized assassinations recently, and the people have had a lot of outcry against the mafia. But this has been going on for some time. There will be assassinations. People come up in arms. There will be investigations, and the government say, well, we're going to do something about it, but then nothing ever gets done. It's business as usual. And that is because, according to the World Press Review articles, the establishment in Italy is right in bed, has a very cozy working relationship with the mafia, and so they're not doing anything about it. So they're becoming stronger and stronger all around the world. It's ironic. This parallel development with international capital, and the mafia keeps lockstep right along with it.
Well, according to the New York Times, a rising cost of modernity is depression. If the 20th century ushered in the age of anxiety, its exit, according to the Times, is witnessing the dawn of the age of melancholy. The first international study of major depression reveals a steady rise in the disorder worldwide. The nations as diverse as the United States, Taiwan, Lebanon, and New Zealand, in these countries, in each generation, the possibility of getting serious depression, not just sadness, but a paralyzing listlessness, dejection, self-depreciation, and overwhelming sense of hopelessness, that these days is three times likelier that you're going to get this depression, it's going to set in, than your grandparents. There's been a lot of speculation of why melancholy is on the rise. Some speculate that loss in a belief, a buffer, that has to do more with exposure to toxic substances. And there's been a big debate over why younger Americans also in recent years have had a much, much higher case of melancholy than the former generation. Recent studies in journals in the United States indicate that there's a much, much higher proportion of people that are getting melancholy these days, and it's become a modern epidemic.
The World Press Review says that the Polish government foresees five more years of recession before things start becoming a little bit better for the people in Poland. And it seems that even that 5 years taking it that long was a compromise between the reformists and the people who want to go a little bit slower and ease the pain. But according to Dollars and Cents, it's ironic that the people who are supposedly foisting this on the people, all this pain, are the people who actually used to come from the labor ranks.
Okay, so that was 1993, and we were listening to Frank Murrow. And I don't know if that's Edward R. Murrow's son, but I know he was a professor down there in Austin. And I want to point out, so they're covering like the 1988 election up through Clinton, because they're hiding the SNL scandal this whole time. The Keating Five, four were Democrats. So we see at the beginning of the Reagan administration, we saw James Baker say, "Oh, don't worry about it. You know, the it's just an anomaly, just one or two of these SNLs going bankrupt. But then what we saw was this neoliberal system that we switched to. Carter was all for privatization. And so was a lot of environmentalists and things. They thought big government was actually the problem. And so the problem was they were getting rid of the old FDR people, because there were people that were in charge of banking in the House of Representatives that could stop wars. And we've seen nothing but perpetual war since Central America, since Indonesia, since Chile, Plan Panama, Plan Colombia. Yeah, and so all this money gets pumped in here, and they're skimming profits. So the taxpayers are paying for arms and things for this threat of communism. So 1993, already a year of Clinton. These guys in Austin are my heroes. I want to put that out. But keep in mind, Alex Jones had a show on this cable station in Austin at the same time. That's how Alex Jones started. And he was almost a comedian. Alex Jones was actually funny when he was on cable, because he was saying, yeah, the Bilderbergers, they're all lizard people. And it's like, get the hell out of here, Alex. That's so damn funny.
Are you saying he wasn't quite as crazy as he is now, but he was still on target?
Yeah. All right. Alex Jones just rolled with the changes when people started getting more paranoid. You know, it's like, you know, even the Oklahoma City bombing was nothing, really, virtually nothing, compared to the people that lost their pensions and their lives in the SNL. But we always see these events, and so the media is doing nothing, Department of Justice is doing nothing, and CIA is doing nothing, and the FCC is, or the Federal Aviation FAA is not doing anything. And these are all the same agencies that were involved that had their head in the sand on 9/11. So 9/11, it was like 30 years in the making. And keep in mind, for a lot of people who really believe that we were pushing forward, we had a lot of information that NASA was putting out on their research up until the Challenger disaster. When the Challenger disaster when that happened, it like, you know, that was like really the last of working class victories.
I had a guy, I'm sorry to interrupt your show. I had a guy once tell me, and he was in the federal government, let's put it deeply in the federal government, and he says after 9/11, he said, it's true, all we're really good at is painting rocks. I'll leave it at that. All we're good at is painting rocks. I'll leave it at that. You guys are a military background. All right.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. The CIA is the most dysfunctional organization that ever was. And if you look at, this period, you know, I look at, you know, like Zelensky wrote that book, The Grand Chessboard. Well, capitalism really is just a game of checkers. You know, because when we got the 8-hour day, the capitalists just brought in World War I and threw the checkerboard on the fucking table. It's like, how do you like them apples? And possibly 100 million, mostly labor, died in World War I. So we had the interwar years, which is the equivalent of a 30 years war. And now, not even a century later, we're at the end of the second 30 years war, beginning with this Iran-Contra, beginning with the killing of Allende. We're at the, so I mean, what the hell, you know, out of 100 years, we got two 30 years wars with like the freaking Korean War and the Vietnam and the war in the middle. The 18th century, there was a French-Indian War. Then we had a freaking step, huh?
And now we're going to do it to the last Ukrainian. We're gonna do it again to the last Ukrainian.
somebody said it, this is a freaking mafia war, and you know when you he pointed out the freaking mafia being the freaking octopus. Well, it was the IWW. It was T-Bone Slim 100 years ago, when the working class took over surrealist art. The octopus with vampire fangs was drawn up by T-Bone Slim. Labor, you know, if you listen to the anti-war stuff in World War One, you know, I mean, 10,000 labor organizers were thrown in prison. Ricardo Flores Magón died in USP Leavenworth. They wouldn't let him out. He had a library of 6,000 books and was published in a newspaper out of Leavenworth. Henry Ford went to Leavenworth Prison. And he said, none of my towns run as good as this prison, as these prisoners run this prison.
Now that's a
thought. Frank Little was.
That is something to say. That's something to think about. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
All right, well, let's go on, because now the hunted becomes the hunter. We're going into Iran-Contra. All right, so 369, Mike.
Well, let's go into the most obvious case that we know of, the one that we have the best documented so far. And this is this Black Eagle thing that was started in 82. Essentially, in a reversal of roles, the CIA is actually created to give the White House and the executive plausible deniability, so they can keep clean, and if the CIA does something wrong, they can, you know, well, we didn't know about it, and they can fire the CIA's director. William Casey reversed this policy, and it was actually quite clever in retrospect in the Iran-Contra thing. He initiated the Iran-Contra thing, but he managed to have Ronald Reagan and the White House take the heat for it. He ran it through Oliver North. So it became a political thing, whereas the CIA was clearly under the thumb of the Congress, or should have been, or legally was. But he also, this Black Eagle operation of delivering arms to the Contras, he got George Bush to front for that, to use the vice president's office to front for that. And Bush was a very activist vice president, running this thing they had on anti-terrorism, supposedly, which is, of course, 1984 doublespeak for, you know, running terrorist activity, mm-hmm. smuggling arms. And through that operation, they began to work through Panama and the planes flying through Panama, and Noriega gave them access to the airstrips that they needed and immediately began working the other end of the line through to Medellin using the same Black Eagle planes to fly drugs up here into the United States. And Bush was, his office was running this thing. Now, obviously, they tried to maintain what I thought was a very thin, implausible deniability of having Don Gregg running the thing right out of George Bush's office with his assistant, what's his name, Samuel Watson, and then Felix Rodriguez down in El Salvador, and then a network that went throughout, planes flying throughout, Southern Air Transport involved, their own airplanes involved, and yet the only deniability was Gregg saying, well, I never told the vice president about all of these things, which is utterly impossible. Mm-hmm. It is not within the realm of human, unless the person were a Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, he would have had to have known what Gregg was doing.
Can you give us a little background on Gregg, the fact that he and Bush had been together in the CIA and buddies for a long time?
Yeah, Gregg was not an original. I think he came into the CIA in 51, a graduate of Williams College. At the height, you know, that was getting into the McCarthy era, the height of conservatism, the Korean War, a very, very conservative era. And he joined and had a, what you know was ultimately tremendously successful career. In fact, I thought that Bush would wind up appointing him as a CIA director, and instead he's gone with William Webster. The guy had to do with the destabilization of Cuba in the 60s. He wound up in Vietnam in Military Region 3 in 1970, and that's the you know where I was, except I didn't overlap with him. But I got there just after he had left, so there were a lot of people were talking about him and about Felix Rodriguez,
who was one of his favored operatives in Vietnam.
In the height of the Phoenix program.
And Felix, Shackley was his boss, wasn't he?
And Shackley was the boss.
So you see the same group moving in with George Bush then in the basement of the White House, right next door to Oliver North.
Minus Shackley.
Shackley wasn't.
Yeah, minus Shackley, who had been squeezed out by then.
But Shackley was still in operation, involved in a lot of these things.
Well, I'm sure the old boy thing worked so that he was in contact with them. But don't ever forget that these people fight a lot. They are as bad as people in the peace movement about 12, literally. You remember when Black Eagle eventually fell apart. And then the Enterprise kind of came apart. Oliver North and Felix Rodriguez were at each other's throats.
Mm-hmm.
And these are two very volatile, unstable, dangerous men who couldn't get along. You remember the incident that's cited in the Foreign Policy Fall 88 issue that broke Black Eagle was when the CIA operatives, it doesn't name them,
mm-hmm.
And Israeli operatives drew their pistols on each other.
This was 1985.
85.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And they were about to start blasting each other away, and the senior head said, everybody cool it, just, you know, slow down, and prevailed and got everybody to put their guns back.
I'm a bit confused. Now, Oliver North's office was next door to George Bush and Donald Gregg's in the bottom of the White House, as I understand it. Now, were they working together, or as I've heard some people say, they actually had two separate arms running and drug smuggling operations going?
Well, they have done everything they could to obfuscate, if you will, and confuse the issue. North admitted that he met with Bush on many occasions, but he minimized the cooperation. The way I see it is... there were a number of different offices, and people did have different roles to play, and there were different power lines working. And don't ever forget that there is just a norm of every presidency since I've been around anyway, is a lot of intense competitiveness. I mean, people, they're really ruthless. Everybody's jockeying for position endlessly inside the White House and the vice president's office, if he has any power. So North was definitely part of the same machinery. He was definitely cooperating with George Bush as Bush was cooperating with Casey. But at the same time, North was definitely beating his own drum and tooting his own horn and flying around the world grandstanding and setting his... They were not what, you know, it was not a disciplined unit like one CIA office would be or one Marine division would be or one of your Navy ships would be. And these are a lot of competing people who are in the same ideology, the same administration, and moving in the same direction with the same evil intention.
The way that the Rolling Stone told this story in their November 3rd essay on the Dirty Secrets of George Bush, the Black Eagle operation that Bush, Rodriguez, and Gregg were running was coming apart because of this rupture with the Israelis. And also because they found out Noriega was running so many drugs that this was threatening the integrity of the operation. So North began this other enterprise, literally called the Enterprise, with Richard Secord and Hakim and these people to bring arms down to the Contras. But Secord had trouble getting it off, so that Felix Rodriguez began another operation. And once Secord got his going, they shut down the operation with Rodriguez's Cuban friends, who had lost a lot of money in this and were very angry. And this began the tension between Rodriguez and Bush and the Secord North group. And eventually the tensions there sort of exploded. And Bush was the guy supposedly trying to hold everything together, that when these other guys, North and Rodriguez, were at each other's throats, Bush was the guy that had to smooth things over. So again, he played a major role in carrying out these operations, according at least to these this Rolling Stone story that seemed fairly well documented.
No, I endorse it the way you describe it is the way I have read it myself, mm-hmm. very much. Mm-hmm. That in fact the original outfit, they had built this giant warehouse called the Arms Supermarket and stocked it with arms which was supposed to be bought by the Contras with the U.S. taxpayers' dollars or the private enterprise dollars. At the time that North pulled away from that enterprise to start the enterprise, they had that thing stocked with $18 million worth of arms. Now, you know, arms is a cash for business, and this cash had to come from the Medellin Colombian cocaine cartel.
Right.
So it was drug money that they had been working with that had stocked this warehouse, counting on selling the arms to the enterprise Smalley, and then North did break away at the point where he saw that thing apparently as getting out of control, as being too explosive. Now, it was not, don't anyone misunderstand that he was morally troubled by working with people who were smuggling drugs. He had known for years these people were smuggling drugs. But as you noted, the volume of it was getting so high that he saw an earthquake coming and actually moved. There also was undoubtedly part of his ego, power play, power struggle at the level of him and Rodriguez, at the level perhaps of him and Gregg.
During this whole time, George Bush was supervisor. He was control of the anti-drug program in the United States, not just the propaganda bit, you know, just say no, but a great and very expensive operation to interdict drugs and to keep them from coming into the United States. So it was a perfect circle, not only from the propaganda point of view, because Bush could be said to be the guy who is keeping it from coming in, but on the covert aspect, he could make sure that this stuff came in undetected.
And yet, none of these stories came out during the election campaign.
We all reflected on that a lot. His choice of quail, as I see it, mm-hmm. was twofold. He had to pick someone who would make him look like a giant, and that was not easy to do. If he picked Bob Dole,
right.
for example,
right.
someone who knew more and had a stronger personality,
right.
He would have all kinds of problems. He also, in my opinion, and this is an analyst's mm-hmm. opinion, you know, this is not based on any hard quotes or anything, very subjective, but he also had to pick someone who was bought into the Iran-Contra scandal, and Quayle was. He was a senator from Indiana, and Indiana's the state that John Hull, you know, came from, who was the man who had the ranch in Costa Rica from which all the drug smuggling and the arms, you know, from the southern side of the Contra thing had been run. And it turns out, as we dug up in August and found out, This young man working for Quayle introduced Hull to Oliver North originally, and that young man's name was Robert Owens.
And Owens was involved in all this?
Owens was working for Quayle when he introduced John Hull. Oh, yes, when he introduced John Hull to Oliver North and gave them that whole option, which evolved into the enterprise and the whole scandal.
That's incredible. The whole interconnections, all of this,
yeah.
Even Quayle. I mean, this is amazing.
To go back, this is a very complicated thing, but mm-hmm. I think we can sort it out. I don't think Bush dared to have someone in office who was clean of the Iran-Contra thing, like Dole, who could benefit from an impeachment.
Lights tricked out in the basement. Oh, England will go.
All right, we're back. It's 8:35. We are turning the corner. And that was John Stockwell. He ran the third sector for military intelligence, Vietnam. Started out a real Boy Scout and started seeing the corruption and actually ran the covert operation in Angola. And so, but they're talking about the Bush 1988 was maybe the most corrupt election of the century. So you had the Democrats keeping their mouths shut about the SNL, which they could have won the election had they brought it up, had not so many Democrats taken money. They were getting rid of all the labor Democrats. So 88 was really, really the death knell of labor in this country. So, yeah, so it's there's some interesting things, you know, about like Ollie North's ego, you know, and clashing with Felix Rodriguez, because I know Mike said, hey, let's do something to talk about Felix Rodriguez. These guys, what happened was the Medellin cartel in 89 or early, maybe even before that, they got their hands on two Russian-made Chinook helicopters, which are basically air cranes, and they bought the parts, and they loaded up a ship from Russia of two helicopters, two parts, all the parts they would need, and they figured out if we could just move 80 tons of cocaine across the mountains to the ports of Colombia in the Atlantic, and Pacific, because Colombia is on the Atlantic and the Pacific. With the CIA looking the other way, all of a sudden it was a guarantee. If you can get coke, it just opened up. It just primed the pump. And then some people may remember, like, when the price of cocaine dropped because there was so much on the streets. It was an overnight thing, just like. Crack on the streets.
It happened in the best of discotheques. I'll tell you that, in the 1980s.
Yeah, that was the disco era was a bigger tragedy than Haight-Ashbury. Think about it.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and then, you know, there was all this, so we had, you know, Reagan closed all the mental institutions, so we all of a sudden we had tens of thousands of disabled people on the streets. All of a sudden, crack has been introduced, AIDS has been introduced, we're getting misinformation about everything from every angle. I mean, literally, the wheels came off of society. By 88... The name of the decade was Apocalypse Culture. And I mentioned this again. It was a band from, like, Springfield, Missouri, a metal band that came up with the name Apocalypse Culture. And they still exist now. They moved out to Portland. They're like underground folk heroes. The band is still together after 30 years. But all of a sudden, we started seeing the strangest behavior. Like the last week of when Reagan was in office, like, the biggest story was the underground, the international satanic underground. And it was the largest FBI investigation in history. I can't make this stuff up, people. It writes itself.
Do you believe this shit?
Yeah. So the thing is like, I mean, there, essentially, you know, we can see this. Even like, and that's one reason why I left the Charlie Rose interview with David Lynch at the beginning, because it's like Charlie Rose was such an arrogant ass. And now we see it now. We didn't realize, you know, he was paying out so much in sexual assault and harassment fees. You know, I mean, it'd make, you know, Bill O'Reilly blush. But there's something about it, and we see filmmakers that capture what the hell was going on in the 80s. And David Lynch, you know, with Twin Peaks, you know, that came out like 89 or 90 or something, man. He was on it. You know, because that series was just all, you know, just the wheel came off of society. There were no heroes in that series. So that's where we are now in this postmodern era. The anti-hero is the person that decides not to kill or not to human traffic. All right, we're going to go on. Now, we're going to go to the anti-hero, which was Gary Webb. And the Iran-Contra story was the first internet story to break. And so he calls in on like Book TV or something on C-SPAN. And so he's given his own biography and what the hell happened in his own words. So that's clip 370, Mike. Hit it.
I saw a dirty overcoat at the foot of the pillar of the road.
Gary Webb is on the line from San Jose, and if you want to stay and talk about this article, I need some help here.
Right.
Gary Webb, are you there this morning?
Yeah, I am.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
How are you?
Very tired. Early out here.
I apologize. You're really nice to do this. We've had so many calls about this, is why we asked you to do it.
Well, I'm happy to talk about it.
I actually heard you on a radio station when I was in Detroit a couple weeks ago for about an hour talking about this. This is what it's all about. It's the San Jose Mercury News, and here's a front page piece in August the 18th. And it's the first of a three-part series. Tell us, in a couple of minutes, what this is about.
It's about a drug ring that operated in San Francisco and Los Angeles in the mid-'80s. And it was connected to a Nicaraguan anti-communist army called the FDN, which was one of the biggest groups that we know as the Contras. And it was selling cocaine in Los Angeles for the most part, but in other areas of the country as well. To the gangs, to the Crips and Bloods down in South Central Los Angeles. And they were taking the money and using some of it, I don't know how much, we haven't figured that out yet, to buy weapons for the Contras. I know it sounds crazy. I know it sounds like the wildest conspiracy theories, which is why all our supporting documentation for the thing is posted on the internet. If anybody's interested, I can give you the internet address a little later on.
Yeah, we've got from the Mercury News here a big chart that you put together from the Sunday story. Did you write all this, by the way?
Yes, I did.
This is a chart that shows how the money left down around Colombia. And can you give us a little bit of this scenario on how these?
I'm not looking at a television right now, but is that the pipeline chart?
It is.
Yeah. Those were the various smuggling routes that the ring used starting in the late 70s up to the early 90s to get the cocaine into the country and to get the money, some of the money back out of the country. Depending on the year and depending on how intense the police scrutiny was, which wasn't very for the most part, those are the different routes they used. They used freighters. They used stolen cars. They would just fly the stuff in suitcases early on when you didn't bring very much in.
Let me read you the first one up here, which is right near Los Angeles. It says, mid-1970s, luxury cars stolen in California were driven to Nicaragua, where they were officially imported by the Nicaraguan military to avoid stiff excise taxes and sold to wealthy Managuans.
Right.
The second number, which is way down here in Peru, it says, mid-late 1970s, Peruvian cocaine was smuggled to Panama, secreted in suitcases and shoes with false bottoms and carried into the U.S. by airline passengers. Points of entry included San Francisco, Los Angeles, Houston, and New Orleans. The third one is late 1970s to 83. Cocaine from the new Cali cartel in Colombia was loaded onto freighters owned by the Gran Colombian line. The freighters were offloaded in the ports of Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, and Seattle. Four, early 1980s, cocaine was flown from Colombia to the Bahamas, where it was loaded aboard small planes and flown into Miami. From there, couriers would take it to California aboard commercial airliners.
Right.
Now, I can go on about this, but where did you get the new information?
You know, it's been public record for 20 years almost. It was just from court files. I mean, eventually, once in a while, they would catch one of these people. The DEA would file an affidavit and lay out what they knew about the drug ring's operations, and it came from, you know, a lot of stuff in National Archives mostly, a lot of these old court cases. And then there were cases in Nicaragua, which laid out the smuggling routes through that country into the United States, so we had the back end of it as well.
Gary Webb, Jack Nelson is at the table. I do want to tell the audience something, because right over your head, you can't see that. Look up on that screen there when we have it. It looks like there's a crack in the window, but that's actually condensation on our window back here because it's so muggy, and it comes right down Jack's head. So I wanted to let
you wouldn't believe how muggy it can get here in Washington.
Yes, I can.
Jack Nelson asked a question.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you, because I haven't read the series. It looks fantastic, but what about the CIA involvement in all of this? Is that...
That part of the story deals with the FDN, that guerrilla army that, mm-hmm. that I mentioned earlier.
Right.
That was, you know, as the Iran-Contra hearings documented pretty
right.
well, that was a creation of the CIA.
Right.
And we track the cocaine dealers who were running this operation all the way up the ladder to the couple of CIA agents that were actually running the FDN,
mm-hmm.
Enrique Bermudez and Adolfo Calero. And let me tell you as a bit of background. Most of this information, or much of the information, came out at a trial in San Diego in March. One of the cocaine brokers, a guy named Danilo Blandone, who was the head of the Southern California operation, has been working for the U.S. government for the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the star witness in a cocaine trafficking trial for the DEA in San Diego. And a lot of this stuff came out under cross-examination when he was up on the witness stand because, the defense was curious, to say the least, about his relationship with the Contras and the Crips. And unfortunately, they couldn't really get into a lot of it because before the trial, the United States filed a motion asking that nobody be allowed to ask Mr. Blandone about his relationship with the CIA. And it was one of the most curious documents I'd ever seen. It said, if true, this matter would be classified, and if false, it shouldn't be allowed at the trial. So,
Did you get
a chance to quiz him in great detail about his relationship there.
Did you get any help at all out of the CIA?
During the investigation?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not. They wouldn't even return my phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
I filed a Freedom of Information Act request for information on Blandone and his boss, Norman Meneses. And I was told that they can't tell me anything because it's a matter of national security.
Gary Webb, where are you from originally?
My dad was in the Marines, so I'm from everywhere.
And how long have you been with the San Jose Mercury News?
I've been with the Mercury 8 years. I was with the Cleveland Plain Dealer 5 years before that.
Where did you go to college?
I went to college in Indiana for a year, and then I went to college in Kentucky.
Where, at Indiana University?
Yeah, IU in Indianapolis, at Community College. And I had a scholarship there, and then my dad got transferred. And I ended up at Northern Kentucky University.
We're going to take a call in a moment, but in your stories also, you say that the Crips and the Bloods, the gangs in L.A. get involved in this. How?
That's the back end of the deal. That's who was buying the cocaine, and they were buying cocaine and they were buying weapons from these fellows.
How much? Can you give us some sense of how big this thing is?
One of the guys that talked to me was the guy who was buying it, a fellow named Freeway Rick Ross. He was the biggest crack wholesaler in Los Angeles during the 1980s. And he says, well, he and Danilo Blandone have both said that, you know, at their peak they were doing 100 kilos a week. And that's just with one dealer. You know, I don't know how much Blandone was selling to other people, but with Rick Ross, he was selling at least 100 kilos a week by 1984, 1985.
Let's take a call, and Jack Nelson's here at the desk with us, and we'll ask both of you gentlemen to get involved.
The one we had that worked, which, I mean, sort of cemented the story for us, was the Freedom of Information Act that we filed with the National Archives. And those folks over there released some FBI documents that had been classified for about 10 years regarding this drug ring and regarding this operation, and we got them out of the files of Iran-Contra Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh. I mean, these are some of the FBI reports that were done either prior to the Walsh investigation as part of something else or as part of the Walsh investigation. But we've got this tool now called the World Wide Web, where you can show people the documents you used. I mean, you can read the story, and if it says set a report, you can click on the word report and actually read the report. If we've got a quote in there and it's highlighted, you can hear what these folks said. Make up your own minds. Don't take my word for it. Nobody knows who I am.
You know, when I was listening to that radio station, I don't even remember which radio station, and don't mention it, please, because I'm going to say something that they won't like. You were set up before you got on in a way you probably didn't even know about.
You're probably right.
And I just wondered how often. I mean, the fellow that was the host had an agenda. He talked about you in a specific way, and by the time you got on, I was listening, thinking, I wonder if Mr. Webb has any idea what he's been saying before you got on the air.
No, I have none. Tell me about it.
Well, I can't hear on the air because I don't remember the name, I don't remember the station, and I don't want to say anything that would be. I can't remember.
But what he did was sandbag him, is that right?
Well, not necessarily, because he was very much in favor of what he had done.
Oh.
So it was just, but it was in a certain way that he set it up, and you got the distinct impression he was just. Overwhelmingly delighted that you had done this, and for a lot of political reasons that he was talking about. Mm-hmm. Let's take one more call for you, and then we'll let you go. Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, go ahead, please. Go ahead.
Actually, to give you a bit of background, I mean, MENA just became an issue since Clinton became president, but the information has been available since the Kerry Committee did its investigation back in 87 and 88. A lot of what I know about MENA came from reading the report of that investigation. As I said, they were on to this East Coast Contra pipeline, which they exposed pretty well. For some reason, that report just never had any resonance with the media.
What's your follow-up on all this?
Obviously now, with things going on, Deutsch has asked for an investigation from the CIA Inspector General. That's one thing we're looking at. There is a lot of talk, especially among the Congressional Black Caucus, about doing hearings on this thing, which is another issue. And then you get the role of the DEA and the Justice Department in this thing, and Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein have both asked for investigations on that. So there's a number of investigations going on in Washington that we're going to be following.
Gary Webb, 5 a.m. out there. Thanks a lot for getting up and telling us about this.
Sure, glad to be here.
And we'll give out the telephone number one more time if you want to get the documents, 408-920-5999. In your life as a journalist, what articles have you written that got the most impact? I mean, he's talking about hearings happening and all this kind of stuff, CIA director getting involved.
Well, I guess the most impact I had was a series I did on a mental institution, the largest mental institution in the world in Milledgeville, Georgia, which had 12,500 patients and 2,500 more on an outpatient basis. And I did a series of stories that showed that the chief surgeon there was away from the hospital at times while a nurse who was his close friend was performing major surgery on patients where another doctor was giving experimental drugs to mental patients.
James A. Baker III, 61st Secretary of State of the United States, and Professor John Meacham.
Mr. President, welcome to Texas.
It's good to be back in Houston. Congratulations on the Texans' victory yesterday.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. They beat the Titans, so no, sir. We don't want that. As I like to say, Tennesseans like to point out that if it weren't for us, y'all would still be part of Spain. So you can thank us later. I made that joke to George W. Bush when he was governor, and he went, that's pretty funny, asshole.
If it wasn't for us, you wouldn't be saying y'all either. You'd
well, that's a good point, sir. I'll defer to that, absolutely. I'm honored to be here. President Reagan, whom Secretary Baker served so wonderfully and so well, used to say that when he was in Hollywood, he would get a call to come to a dinner to speak and perform, and Reagan would say, but I don't sing or dance. And the organizer would say, well, we know, but you can introduce someone who can. So my job is to introduce two people who can. And wanted to start with Secretary Baker and thank him for the remarkable institute, but even more important, the half century of service to America and to the world. And
thank you.
It is... as someone who spends most of his time thinking about the past and talking to dead people, and it's when they talk back that you're in trouble, I must say that it's hard to imagine, and it's a great tribute to our country, that two such different people come to the pinnacle of power and are able to lead the nation and the world in such a remarkable way. We have a man from Texas and Princeton and a Marine who served Republican administrations. We have the 44th president of the United States from Hawaii by way of the Ivy League. And what brings them together is, I think, what brings the country together, which is a shared sense that we have to push forward to a more perfect union. And so the subject of a more perfect union is what I'd like to talk about tonight. So, Mr. Secretary, ordinarily, of course, the president would go first, but in an age before beauty moment, I'd like to...
you got that right.
I'd like to ask. So what I'd like for us to talk about is how the world worked on your watches, how Washington worked on your watches, and how they didn't work, and what can we learn from both those positive and negative experiences. And so just for narrative purposes, sir, when you went to Washington in 1981 as Chief of Staff, what was the ambient reality of Washington for you? It wasn't perfect. It wasn't a great bipartisan Valhalla. There were tough fights. But what was it like? What did it feel like? How hard was it to get things done?
Thank you, John. Before I answer that question or try to, let me simply say that, Mr. President, you honor us by being here tonight, and we're very, very clear. We're very appreciative and very grateful for your being here. We were having dinner, and when Ed Derigian was announcing all those big dollar numbers, I looked at the president. I said, Mr. President, 10% of that's yours. He said, the hell it is. I'm not letting you off that cheap. He said, I want the Rolodex.
So in the politics of eternity, the crucial concept is actually innocence. There's some world back there where we were always doing the right thing, where evil was always on the other side of some border, where things were simple. And that this kind of politician, a politician of eternity, thrives by constantly invoking that past, by invoking the innocence of his people, the real nation, as opposed to the guilt, which is all on the other side.
Now, this kind of all right, we're back. It's been another war on Christmas. Maybe we'll do an episode called How I Won the War on Christmas. Thank you all.
Oh man, what a show. I mean, it's interesting that here you have James Baker and Obama, Barack Obama in Texas with James Baker talking about their legacies. Crazy stuff. It really is crazy stuff, man. That's
That whiskey is like $500 a glass.
Oh man, we gotta close with that. I mean, that's a great one. God.
All right.
And your bankers too. Look, get up and learn those rules. When the man and the crazy chief, one says sun and one says sea. AM and FM, the PM too, turning out that boogaloo. Gets you up and I get you out, but how long can you keep it up? Give me Honda, keep me stunning, so cheap and real phony. Hong Kong dollar, Indian cent,